This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The arrest of a Kalamazoo doctor by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents has brought new attention in Southwest Michigan to the issue of immigration and deportation. The first reporting of the story of Lucas Neese came soon after a Detroit-area man was deported to Mexico. Jorge Garcia came to the United States when he was 10 and was deported after 30 years in this country. We're going to discuss what these cases tell us about immigration with Susan Reed. She is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Thank you for being here, Susan.
Thank you, Gordon.
I want to go back to something that you said to Channel 3 regarding Dr. Neese, that you said that this was an example of the system working as it was designed to work. How so?
Sure. Well, and just to be very clear, you know, my office is not representing Dr. Neese, and I don't have any more information about that situation than other folks do. But based on the sort of basic framework, which is a person who is a lawful permanent resident being detained by immigration and charged with deportation, apparently based on old criminal convictions, right, that ICE will be alleging meet the standard for deportation.
Going back about 25 years. Right.
Exactly. Going back in this case, quite a long time and to some degree an unusually long time. That is the system that we have. Non-citizens are very vulnerable to deportation. In 1996, a large number of new grounds for removal were added to the law. And those included, for example, virtually any controlled substance conviction other than possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana, and a number of other types of convictions that made people deportable. And again, just to give you an example of how this system was designed to work, people who pled guilty to perhaps cocaine possession as a youth or possession of more than 30 grams of marijuana at a time when it was not a deportable offense, became deportable in 1996. And so I think one of the things that surprised people most, right, was this idea of, well, but these convictions were so long ago. Our system was designed to have that not matter if at any time. Not only does the government, if at any time the government becomes aware of something, they can pursue deportation, but if at any time after a conviction, the government freshly makes that a ground of deportation, you can be prosecuted for deportation. So it's a system that is really designed to be extremely punitive, and it's not a system that's designed to have a lot of consideration of equities.
And one of the things that we have found out about Dr. Neese's case is that ICE says this sort of came onto their radar because of encounters that he had with the police over the years, 18 of them. Some of these are speeding tickets. Some of these are things which are a little more serious. But is it a combination of these two things, or is that what it appears to be to you, that it's these two convictions from long ago plus these so-called encounters with police?
Yeah, you know, there are lots of ways that people come to ICE's attention long after a criminal conviction makes them deportable, or come to ICE's attention because they actually just don't have a status. And, you know, a couple of common examples would be green cards have to be renewed every 10 years. So after that 1996 law that I mentioned earlier, all of a sudden in 2006, people go to renew their green cards and, oh, this conviction that's 10, 15, 20 years old is suddenly coming onto the radar for the first time. Another thing that frequently gets folks put into deportation proceedings is actually when they apply for citizenship or apply for green cards and don't end up being eligible. Those cases often get referred to ICE. So I always think that's interesting when people say, oh, well, you know, why didn't this person just apply for citizenship? Well, often if you don't have the right advice, the right analysis, the right knowledge, or the government gets it wrong, it's applying for citizenship that gets you put into deportation proceedings. But in this case, I thought it was particularly chilling to hear this language come from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that apparently what prompted their action was that there had been police encounters. You know, our Constitution promises us due process, and I don't know what a police encounter is. I've been practicing immigration law for 15 years. It's not a special immigration law term. I don't think my colleagues who do criminal defense exactly know what a police encounter is. And so to see the government taking action that could be devastating against a person based on this number of police encounters. How many encounters is too many, Gordon? Can you get 5 speeding tickets before you get put in deportation proceedings? Can you only get 2? If the police come and ask me a question and I answer it, is that a police encounter? What if I don't answer it? Is that a police encounter? I found that language of police encounter as the impetus for this prosecution to be very unsettling from a civil liberties perspective.
Are the rules here well-defined at all? I mean, what you're saying there is that we don't sound like we really know what triggers ICE coming in and having a look. Do we have a good idea of what does trigger deportation in terms of a legal threshold where, you know, do you have to be actually convicted of a serious crime to be deported? Can you be deported for less than that?
Well, I think in some ways it's simple and in some ways it's incredibly complex. So if we were to get out a copy of the Immigration and Nationality Act, we could look at Section 237 and we could see a list of all the different crimes that you can lose your green card or other status that you might have for having committed. But that list has to line up differently with the list in every one of 50 states. So to give you an example, in some states, writing a bad check is what's called a crime of moral turpitude, which in some cases can get you deported because the state statute says knowingly writing a bad check. But if you got convicted in a state where just writing the bad check made you guilty, then it's not necessarily a crime of moral turpitude. And there is so much jargon and there are just a huge volume of court cases that are different for every one of our circuit courts of appeals. So it's not clear, right? Because every single criminal offense requires an analysis of whether or not it would make a non-citizen deportable. And there are some very surprising offenses that make people deportable. And so that analysis has to happen. A little bit of good news about it is there's a Supreme Court case called Padilla versus Kentucky that does require criminal defense counsel to give accurate, complete information. Mr. Padilla in that case was a Vietnam vet, green card holder for decades, who was accused of transporting marijuana. He was a semi-truck hauler. And his attorney told him, "Don't worry, you've been here so long. You're a Vietnam vet. You're not going to get deported over this. Go ahead and plead guilty," right? And he did, and he got ordered deported. And that was the case where the Supreme Court said, yeah, we really do need to get people accurate information before a plea. So, you know, in some ways, the law is laid out very clearly in statute, but the ability to interpret it correctly is very challenging.
You mentioned that there should be due process. How quickly can things move in terms of deportation, and is there adequate time for an organization, maybe like the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, to provide an adequate defense for someone who may be facing deportation?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges. One reason we get involved at all is because, unlike in criminal proceedings where the Supreme Court has said that due process requires that an attorney be appointed for you if you cannot afford your own attorney, that does not apply in immigration proceedings. They're
considered civil. So you don't necessarily get a public defender.
Absolutely not, no. And so there are people who are detained and deported who never, ever speak with an attorney about any defense that they might have to their deportation, about any civil rights violations that might have happened in the context of their detention. And actually, even if your Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure are violated by ICE, you have to show that it was an egregious violation in order for that to defend you against your deportation. So it's not like on Law and Order, right, where if Lenny and the boys make some mistakes, then the DA gets after them because it messes up the prosecution. Often when ICE makes mistakes, it doesn't really have an impact on the prosecution, so there's a real incentive problem there. In terms of other challenges, the detained docket actually moves really pretty quickly. The wait right now for a bond hearing is very long, and I think we saw that come forward in this local case where it takes about a month to get a bond hearing. But your actual process moves reasonably quickly, and if you can afford counsel or if there's a well-funded nonprofit able to assist you, which most of the time, unfortunately, there is not, about 90% of people who are detained don't end up having counsel. If that all happens, if you're detained, the process moves relatively quickly, you know, with time to prepare your case. non-detained people in immigration proceedings, the cases take years. I have court dates scheduled for 2020.
And I want to note regarding Dr. Lucas-Niess, we are speaking on Friday, and there is a bond hearing which is scheduled for Friday. And so there may be news on Dr. Niess that you and I don't discuss here, and people may wonder why. It's because we're recording Friday.
That's actually really quite fast.
It was moved up.
Good for him.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the case of Jorge Garcia over in Detroit, someone who came to the United States at the age of 10. He was here 30 years before he was deported. How common is this, and is it likely to be more common if there is going to be stepped up enforcement?
Well, a case like Jorge Garcia's got significantly less common in 2012 when President Obama created the DACA program. The problem for Jorge Garcia is he was actually too old to benefit from DACA. Folks had to be under 30 to benefit from DACA. And so that creates an interesting dynamic where here's Jorge Garcia in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, older than most DACA recipients. So by most calculations, you'd think, gosh, well, this guy has more equities, to use the legal term, right? He's been here longer. He has his family. But he was outside of the DACA program because he was too old. If that doesn't seem fair, well, welcome to the immigration system. You know, so for the people, though, who did manage to be in that DACA group, President Obama's 2012 decision to initiate the deferred action program for that specific group of people who did have, who and still do, right, have so many equities, did stop a lot of those folks from being put in deportation proceedings, right? And what would that have looked like? Well, in Jorge Garcia's case, he applied for a green card through his U.S. citizen wife. I think most people who watch movies, right, think that if you marry a citizen, you get a green card. A lot of people don't even seem to think there's an application process, right? It's just magic. But in fact, lots of undocumented people, even though they marry citizens, even though they have citizen children, are not eligible for green cards, are not eligible for citizenship. And like I mentioned earlier, it's applying that triggers the enforcement. I would say Jorge Garcia's case is uncommon in that he just missed that DACA threshold, and DACA has been protecting so many people for the past 5 years. But 122 people lose DACA every day since the Trump administration's September 5th decision to terminate the program. And starting on March 5th, many more, many thousands of people will lose their DACA every day. And, you know, really just to underline one more thing again, because it gets a little circular, right? I'm just seeing a lot of why didn't they apply for citizenship? They're not eligible for citizenship. They applied for the first legalization program they were eligible for, the DACA program, and that's what they're asking for.
Once someone is deported, of course, Jorge Garcia's family is hoping that they're going to be able to get him back here. But once somebody is out of the country, how tough is it then to get back, you know, regardless of, you know, even if there's a change in law or there's a new court ruling, how tough is it to get them back here and get back to square one?
It can be very difficult. And that's why that family, you know, fought every year for discretion following him being ordered deported and received that discretionary grant from the Obama administration every year for, I believe, the past 6 years. Again, I'm not counsel in that case either, but I'm more familiar with it. It can be very difficult for a number of reasons. A deportation order generally comes with a 10-year bar to reentering the United States. In some cases, it's a 20-year bar, and that bar can only be waived in certain circumstances. There is an application process for a waiver. Some immigrants may trigger other bars when they depart the U.S. that have to do with prior unlawful presence. That wouldn't be the case probably in Jorge Garcia's case, but I suppose it could be. Again, it's not my case. In his case, I assume that the family will begin the process of seeking those waivers, but it can take years.
So I want to go back to what you've mentioned a couple times about citizenship, that this could actually be the thing that gets you deported. Mm-hmm. What is the right way of finding out that you can start this process and successfully complete it? Is there a good place to go, a good resource that kind of gives you that first check to say, oh yeah, you're in good shape, don't worry, or maybe tells you, you know what, you would be better off not exposing yourself to the forces which might cause you to be deported.
Yeah, people need a full analysis by competent immigration counsel before they file anything with the government. And so then the next question, right, is how do you find competent immigration counsel? We are always very happy to make referrals or screen people for our services at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. There are several other local providers for low-income folks, including the Catholic Diocese of Kalamazoo has an attorney-staffed program, Justice for Our Neighbors West Michigan, based at First United Methodist Church. And so we refer people to, you know, attorneys that we're aware of who practice immigration law statewide. Often they're members of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, although not necessarily. It's a very expensive membership fee. And so, you know, we do make referrals to people whose work we're familiar with, and we're happy to do that. But there are a lot of scams. There's a phenomenon called the notario público. The term notary public in the Spanish-speaking world means like a super lawyer, someone with a high level, an attorney who has a higher level of certification. And of course, in the U.S., a notary public is, you know, just someone who paid their fee and got their seal to witness signatures and check IDs. And so we do see that phenomenon of people practicing law as notary publics, or notaries public, I should say. We see the phenomenon of dabblers, right? Attorneys who think, oh, how hard could this be? It's filling out forms, right? Without that sense that if you fill out the wrong form, it doesn't just get rejected. It gets that person deported.
Oftentimes in the whole discussion of immigration policy, there's this talk of sort of a middle ground where maybe some people don't actually have a pathway to citizenship, but they can stay here legally. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, you know, guest worker programs and those sort of things. But I wonder if these examples that we've talked about, Dr. Nice and Jorge Garcia, if they maybe don't demonstrate that if you are not a citizen, there is some limbo there. That is, citizenship is probably the only way to get yourself firmly on the other side of not being someone who can be deported.
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of our core values at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center is equity for immigrants and immigrant communities. I think equity is an American value. And to put people in a position, which I totally acknowledge, you know, there are movement voices who said we should have just taken work permits a long time ago and we wouldn't be suffering the way we are now. And I really listen to and respect that perspective that going for the brass ring of citizenship has just not been attainable and has left people vulnerable. I think some hidden concerns in addition to the ones you mentioned, that ongoing vulnerability to deportation, is a scenario that I'm seeing a lot, which is aging undocumented parents of U.S. citizens, right? Not eligible for Medicare, not eligible for Medicaid, no Social Security. You know, we often have that call from that family that says, we are paying cash for my mom's dialysis because she's undocumented. She can't work anymore. How can we get, often it's the dialysis center, honestly, calling to say, how can we get this person's status so we can get them this health care that they need? Well, you know, the first bit of bad news is there's usually not a way to do that. And then the second bit of bad news is even if we found that green card needle in the haystack, you're not eligible for Medicaid until you've had your green card for 5 years. So as I see a generation of people who have worked incredibly hard in some of the most dangerous industries in our country, aging and dealing with the same human disability and age-related challenges that we all face, I see a generation of, in this community, predominantly Latino families entrenched in poverty because the costs of caring for their aging undocumented loved ones are going to prevent them from investing in their children's education, investing in homes. That's a phenomenon that I see that's real. And so I really think that a path to citizenship is an important value, even as politically challenging as that is appearing right now.
And when you see some of the disputes over things like DACA, I mean, how big a climb does it seem to be to get to some sort of path to citizenship as a grand immigration bargain down the road?
Well, I mean, That is a policy, you know, a path to citizenship, earned legalization. Those are policies that have incredibly broad support in the American public and would pass this Congress and would pass a lot of other Congresses of the past if they were brought to the floor. The problem is none of those compromises have been able to beat the Hastert rule. None of them have been able to be passed with only majority party votes. So on the one hand, I think most people just see the fact that these are impossible situations, and most people respond with compassion and without a desire to just be punitive for being punitive's sake. But the thing that we're seeing right now in the politics that's very disheartening is that these folks who have DACA, who have such compelling stories, their futures are really being held hostage to this extremely destructive agenda that seeks to not only not create a pathway for other undocumented people, which again is a policy that would have broad support, but also reduce legal paths to immigrate, which I have always heard from folks on that side of the aisle that there was no opposition to folks who immigrate legally. And it certainly makes me wonder if really the opposition hasn't been about race and culture all along. Whenever I used to suggest that, folks would say they had no opposition to legal immigration. But I don't hear a lot of people trying to argue that limiting legal immigration goes against their values who argued from that side, if that makes sense.
Susan Reed is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. As always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.